Hey, folks, starting today, one of our favorite sponsors, SunsetLakeSebade.com, is doing a 30% off sale with the coupon Friday. Sunset Lake Sebade and the Majority Report are teaming up again to turn America's most consumerist holiday into a fundraising opportunity for a great organization. Here's how it works. Visit SunsetLakeSebade.com starting today. All Sebade products will be 30% off with the coupon code Friday. And that's not all. Orders over $100 are going to receive a jar of Sebade gummies, a $40 value, for free. Sunset Lake Sebade is going to donate 10% of the proceeds from this Black Friday sale, which actually lasts all week, to Feeding Chittenden. It is the largest emergency food provider in Vermont, feeding over 12,000 people each year. This is coming off the heels of Sunset Lake just doing a sale, I guess it was a week ago, or on Election Day, that raised $2,500 for Planned Parenthood. We're going to match that. So that's $5,000 to Planned Parenthood. On top of which, of course, you've heard me talk about the Sunset Lake products many, many times. I used them last night. I used them over the weekend. I used the tincture to go to sleep. I used the gummies. Sometimes to sleep, the melatonin ones, sometimes the regular ones just to chill out, and sometimes the one with a little tiny bit of THC, where for someone like me, it is pretty
potent.
It's more potent than one would think, because it's actually under the legal limit, but it is it's a fun evening for me. And also I use smokables if I have a nice meal. And maybe I want to loosen up after that.
Post-prandial?
Exactly. I'm not sure what that means.
It means after dinner.
Oh, yeah. Bien sûr.
Yeah, I knew that.
Bien sûr. Anyways, they're a great company. Sunset Lake Sebade is a majority employee-owned business. They pay a minimum wage of $20 an hour. This past year, like I said earlier, Sunset Lake Sebade has donated more than $26,000 to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, refugee resettlement organizations. They gave a bunch to Give Directly. Just a great company, great product, and now a great sale. 30% off. You visit SunsetLakeSebade.com. Use the coupon code Friday. You will take advantage of these deals. 30% off. The sale ends November 27th. Some restrictions may apply. Meanwhile, on with the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, November 21st, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps to the industrial ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heart of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer Raina Lipsitch, author of The Rise of the New Left, How Young Radicals Are Shaping the Future of American Politics. Also on the program today, five killed in a shooting at a gay nightclub in Colorado. Motive still unclear. Meanwhile, a report: Sam Alito appears to have leaked the Hobby Lobby decision to anti-abortion group funders back in 2014.
Say it ain't so.
What happened to all those calls to jail the leaker?
Garland named special counsel for the Trump criminal probe. One of the largest rail unions in the country rejects the contract. Strike looms. Carrie Lake now claims her voters were disenfranchised, and an Arizona lawmaker claims she will protest by not taking a vote in the Arizona House until the 2022 election is redone. Republicans may end up with the same size majority in the 2023 House as Democrats now have. Georgia judge allows for voting in a runoff for the Senate race there to start this Saturday. At COP27, rich countries agree to a fund to aid poor countries dealing with climate change, but no work on actually slowing climate change. Power blackouts roll across Ukraine as Russia continues to target civilian infrastructure. And anti-abortion groups sue the FDA to deauthorize an abortion drug. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Monday. We got a short week this week. Well, not a short week, actually. We have one day that will be off. That will be Thursday, I assume. Emma Vigeland, welcome. You're here. You are going to be celebrating Thanksgiving this year.
Yes.
Breaking tradition and celebrating Thanksgiving.
Yes. This year I will be celebrating, and it'll be a nice one. We'll have a little bit of a break and we'll get to, you know, watch some football. David Griscom trash talking me on Twitter last night about the Cowboys and Giants. I don't feel good about the game, but that's beside the point.
Takes like 0.05 seconds for me to say Thanksgiving and you immediately think football.
I mean, right? That's bait. Like, you were baiting me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
And it means that you'll be able to watch that many more football games this week because you've got multiple ones on Thursday, which means you can consume all of them on Sunday and not have to worry about ones that you might miss.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of optimal in that way.
This is like your actual Christmas.
Right, right. Christmas is on the Sunday, though, this year.
Except there's football on Christmas.
Yeah, they are playing. Ruining Matt's, like, kind of NBA domination.
Coaching on basketball.
Yeah,
time.
Right. I know. NBA's going to be pissed.
We will, we're going to spend some time later in the program, obviously, talking about what happened in Colorado Springs, because in many respects, we don't know the motive yet, and it's always best to wait for that, but fairly inevitable. That, and maybe not even inevitable as a result, but perhaps the desired result. I mean, we've talked about bomb threats at children's hospitals that provide any type of gender-affirming care. And there was a report that this Q Club in Colorado Springs was having drag shows. This is, of course, the number one animating issue for people on the right in this country now. The existence of drag shows suddenly has become the greatest threat to the country as they cycle through their different threats and land on, more often than not, folks that are marginalized in our society because they don't have the political power often to push back. We will get to that later. We'll also talk, obviously, about the story that Sam Alito has a history of leaking Supreme Court decisions for political purposes. Very important story in my estimation because of both just the implications of it on its face and also in terms of what it means regarding the leaking of the Dobbs decision in overturning Roe v. Wade. And really, the real point about this is that it will force some, not all, not even the majority, of folks in the legal institution to come to terms with the idea that just because you are a Supreme Court justice or you are nominated to be a Supreme Court justice does not mean that you aren't simply a political operative. And that's a really important realization that I think many in the country have come to understand. But folks in the legal profession need to understand it. And folks who care about the future of the direction need to understand it so that they can vote and operate and pressure legislatures for reform with that understanding. Because they're not going to stop.
No. And any further like canonization of the Supreme Court only serves the Alitos of the world, because when you don't treat the enemy as what they are, then you don't actually have the ability to fight them, to fight these right-wing extremists.
Exactly. And But let's turn to the Republican Party for a moment. One of the best things, I think, for those of us who don't want the Republican Party to obtain any more power in 2024, is the idea that there is a perception amongst the Republicans that Donald Trump is has been weakened in some way by the 2022 elections, which means that there's a lot of very ambitious morons who are excited about maybe becoming president. And here is Mike Pence raising his hand saying, I am, in fact, one of those very ambitious morons. And you'll recall Mike Pence, the last time we really heard about him was that there was a lot of people who wanted to put him on the end, the bad end of a noose, because he wouldn't give the election to Donald Trump. He seemed to be a little bit upset about that at the time. But, you know, after a while, time heals all wounds. Right. And here is Mike Pence doing his best George W. Bush knockoff.
Do you think the president committed a criminal act in fomenting the insurrection? Do you think a crime was committed?
Well, I don't know if it is criminal to listen to bad advice from lawyers. Truth is, what the president
folks. So, for those of you, you should just know this. Now, Mike Pence is not a judge. He is not a prosecutor. He's not a police officer. So, you know, take this with a bit of a grain of salt. But if you are contemplating committing a crime, make sure you find a lawyer who looks at you and says, I'd do it. Because apparently Mike Pence does not know if that's criminal act, if you commit a criminal act because you're listening on the advice of lawyers.
Well, a lawyer can lead a horse to a crime, but only the horse can choose to commit the crime, is my counter to his argument here.
Yes, well, Mike Pence would say, like, he's a horse, and so he has no free will. So,
well, I mean, a little bit more applicable than we thought in this.
Checkmate
instance.
Mike Pence. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Here is Mike Pence. Let's let him continue. Sorry.
If it is criminal to listen to bad advice from lawyers, truth is, what the president was repeating
alert,
is what he was hearing
from
that gaggle of attorneys around him. And, you know, presidents, just as like all of us that have served in public life, you have to rely on your team. You have to rely on the credibility of the people around you. And so...
like your vice president?
You know, and you determine the people.
As time goes on, I hope... I hope we can move beyond this, beyond that prospect. And this is really a time when our country ought to be healing. And frankly, the Justice Department's actions have been exposed from during our administration, where FBI agents were advancing political agendas.
Pause it for 1 second. Sorry, I just have to he must be referring to the Durham investigation, which has been going on now for 4 years. And has had exactly zero indictments. Oh, no, excuse me, zero convictions on the two really shoddy indictments.
The star defendant was acquitted.
The star, yes.
Igor Danchenko was not acquitted, was not convicted of any charges.
Well, and to be fair, it did take the jury almost like 2.5 hours to deliberate on that. I mean, almost 2.5 hours. Durham, for all I know, is just like sitting in an office, you know, banging his fists on the table going, what have I done with the last 4 years of my life? So they, in fact, did not find anything of the sorts. But let's let Mike Pence continue to essentially woo the Trump voter again.
Frankly, the Justice Department's actions have been exposed from during our administration, where FBI agents were advancing political agendas, falsifying records, using what came to be found out to be opposition research paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party, the so-called dossier. And then this past summer, when we see the Justice Department execute a search warrant against personal residence of a former president of the United States, I think the American people Yeah. I think the American people join me in hoping we can move past this contention.
But is he above the law? I mean, if he violated the law, should he be held to the same standard that I
hey, Chuck.
To? Chuck, no one's
no
above
one's
the
above
law.
Law.
But I would hope the Justice Department would give careful consideration.
In other words, I'm implying they didn't give careful consideration.
He's not above the law. He's at the same point.
Hey, Chuck. Nobody's above the law. Chuck, let me tell you something. Nobody's above the law. And I just want to imply that the DOJ went down to Mar-a-Lago and just on a whim decided they needed that stolen government documents back after 18 months of begging the president, former president, to give it back.
He really has perfected the... I'm saying this very thoughtfully.
I'm trying to... Listen. Mm. I'm trying to get across that that I'm both homespun, but also thoughtful. Is that clock with you? Chuck Todd. Yeah. And I got to say, man, wow, Chuck Todd really grilled the hell out of it.
75 years of Meet the Press and glory there.
Yep, there you go. I mean...
Yeah, we're supposed to be healing, which is to say, I'm supposed to be in office serving my second term, and we're not going to heal until I do that, Mike.
Yeah, you know, Trump is the kind of guy that just, he carefully sits down with his advisors and his lawyers, and then he makes a determination about how he's going to act from there. That's the bullshit that Pence is trying to sell us there.
But... Millennial Industrial Complex says Sam's Pence voice sounds a lot like W, and that is on purpose, because that's what Pence is trying to go for.
He sounds like
you know, Chuck, it's Sunday, and so I really appreciate you leaving me that gaping hole at the front line as you open up a running lane for me. Thanks for not trying to do any tackle or even two-hand touch as I just spread a bunch of bull. All right. Yeah, I know, folks. Everybody's telling me that my Pence sounds like GW. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but, I mean, Pence wishes he could be as fun as GW, yeah. Right?
Like, well, that's true.
I got to come up with some nicknames for people.
No, man. Can you imagine Pence trying to write comedy?
He has to check with Mother first.
Yes. Mother says, Mommy, that's what I call it. That's a nickname I have for her.
I call him Humpty Dumpty Trump.
Folks, we're going to, in just a moment, we'll be talking to Raina Lipsitch. She is the author of The Rise of the New Left, How Young Radicals Are Shaping the Future of American Politics. But first, a couple words from our sponsors today. One of our sponsors today is Kamakoto. Kamakoto makes great Japanese steel kitchen knives using traditional techniques from Japan. Kamakoto builds on the legacy of over 800 years of Japanese technology and expertise. They create knives that have been meticulously handcrafted from traditional techniques dating back to the Edo period of Japan. Kamakoto only uses steel sourced from mills in Japan. Each blade is crafted using techniques that have been honed and perfected by generations of knifesmiths. Each Kamakoto knife goes through a rigorous 9-step process that takes several years from start to finish to complete. Each knife is individually inspected with a lifetime guarantee. The knives come in a heavy-duty ash box. We got the box over there. It's gorgeous, actually. It makes a great present, a great time of year for it, and it makes them really easy to store. And because they have a single bevel edge, Kamakoto knives can be can achieve unbelievable sharpness that you can't get with other knives. They can cut through your ribeye like butter. You can maintain the edge of your blades with one of the Kamakoto sharpening whetstones. Kamakoto knives are used by several chefs working at Michelin star restaurants. A great gift for someone that you know cares about cooking. And like folks take lessons in cutting. I've never done that myself, but a good knife, very important to have. Kamakoto right now is running a Black Friday sale, offering my viewers and listeners an extra $50 off any purchase with the discount code MAJORITY on top of their other special offers. Go to kamakoto.com/majority to get your knife set and help support the channel. We'll put the links in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Also, for me, one of the things, I got to get a lot of OPSEC around here. There's a lot of sites that will publish your personal information. Aura, not only do they provide all sorts of other security for your online, they automatically fight against those annoying websites by automatically requesting removal of your info, and this helps reduce robocalls and nasty letters to your home if you're the type of person who gets them. But it also is nice to have less of your info out there. But even maybe more importantly, Oura protects you from scammers and hackers by scanning the dark web. This is where criminals trade stolen information, and you can basically, well, not basically, you can literally look up your emails and your family's emails, look up the see how many passwords have been compromised, maybe social security numbers to see if those have been compromised. It alerts you fast if it finds anything. Oura gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if someone was opening a loan or a credit card in your name. Oura has a VPN as well that allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. Oura protects your devices from viruses, malware, spyware, so bad guys can't break in. Oura helps you manage what your kids can do with their devices. That came in handy, I'm not going to lie. There was a little bit of an issue at my home on Friday. Somebody lost their YouTube and their computer privileges. And you don't like that happening. And there's one way to make sure that they can't go around that is, well, I've shut it down. I'm not telling folks how to parent. But what you can do is you can restrict specific apps too and set screen time limits. You can even set focus times to ensure your kid is doing their homework instead of binging on YouTube. And lastly, Oura's password manager lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. You can try Oura for free for 14 days at Oura.com/majority. When you put your email in and test it out, if you're like me, you're going to be shocked at how much of your private information Oura finds that has been exposed or compromised over the next 2 weeks of your free trial. That's Oura.com/majority to try Oura for free for 14 days. And lastly, I have broken down and, you know, because I was going in to order another, some more pillowcases from Cozy Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I had basically said, like, I'm not a loungewear guy.
Oh, but
there's
you got
something
some.
About like winter, you start to go like, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
On the weekends, do I really like, we're not going out, you know, Saul and I are not going to go out to the park the first thing in the morning or something like that. And so I may want to hang around the house. I have ordered a couple of like, you know, like loungy shirts, I guess. But that's a great time and it's a great gift at Cozy Earth. It is Oprah's favorite things 5 years in a row, apparently. Cozy Earth bedding is made by using the finest premium viscose from highly sustainable bamboo. Their bedding is naturally temperature regulating so that you'll sleep comfy all year round. And it's true, folks. That's why I was getting more pillowcases because my head is getting too hot. I don't know what's going on with that. Anyways, you can also, like I said, level up your lounging with Cozy Earth's luxurious loungewear collection. They have soft and stylish bamboo pajamas, joggers, tees, and more. And you can check out their new premium plush and waffle bath towels. I got to get some bath towels, actually. You and your loved ones are going to adore those, too. Every Cozy Earth bedding item comes in a beautiful reusable canvas bag. No gift wrapping. This is a great time to get some loungewear for someone for a gift. Like, I'm starting to notice, like, that's all that people wear out and about now. I think that's like a post, COVID thing.
For
people
sure.
are just like, comfort overall. Right now, you can save 40% on Cozy Earth. You gotta hurry because the holiday offer ends soon. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter majority at checkout. Save 40%. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. All backed by a 100-night sleep guarantee. CozyEarth.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, writer Raina Lipsitch will be here, author of The Rise of a New Left, How Young Radicals Are Shaping the Future of American Politics. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining us, writer Raina Lipsitz, author of The Rise of a New Left, How Young Radicals Are Shaping the Future of American Politics. Raina, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start, and I certainly have been watching this sort of, broadly speaking, this massive change that appears to have happened, at least maybe a trajectory of massive change that has happened. When would you peg this as beginning, this rise of a new left?
I mean, it really depends on how you count. I usually say that it goes back to Occupy Wall Street 2011. And that's where my book kind of begins. A lot of the book is about what happened post 2015 as an outgrowth of the Bernie campaign. But I think that you can really trace it to Occupy Wall Street and the dawning of a new kind of era of class consciousness that we hadn't seen in this country for, 50 years previously.
What is the, and I guess we'll sort of keep circling back to this on some level, but what is the main impetus of that class consciousness?
Well, one thing I found when I was working on the book is the number of people I spoke to, I interviewed for the book, who were radicalized essentially in the Obama era, right? And so these were a lot of very many of whom had worked really hard to get Barack Obama elected. And then when he was elected, I think that they expected that there'd be progress on a number of issues, on the environment, on immigration, immigrants' rights, and sort of also on reproductive freedom. And then they didn't see the changes that they were hoping for and the changes that they felt like they were promised by Barack Obama and by the sort of new hope of that administration. So I think a lot of it came from a sort of disappointment with what turned out to be, in many ways, politics as usual, and was not what people were hoping for in that moment.
I'm curious. I mean, you mentioned environment, immigrant rights, reproductive rights, but none of those necessarily, as a first order, I guess, issue, deal with questions that maybe are most obviously associated with class, right? Like, I mean, so how do you account for that? That like sort of there become, or is there something else that's going on simultaneously that these things may sort of, the failure of the Democrats to deal with those things during the Obama years in a sufficient way creates an environment of more radicalization?
I think there were sort of a bunch of different things happening at once, and I think, but in a related way. So I think that frustration that people had, especially young people, with the idea that, they'd been told their whole lives, if you vote and if you work for Democrats, we're going to move forward on these issues. And they just weren't seeing those changes. And that became an impetus, I think, for a lot of people to get more interested in the history of organized labor and to become more interested also in workplace organizing. And I think people started to see the connections between class consciousness and labor issues and control within a workplace and how that ties into across the board power for, especially for oppressed groups and for, people whose rights had been stripped away. I don't think that that's always, those things are always linked, right? I think we see a lot of examples in American politics where people try to separate those into distinct strands. But I think for a lot of younger people, they started to see those connections more clearly, that, part of having power as a woman, as a minority, as somebody who has been disenfranchised in any number of ways, is having power as a worker and having some kind of feeling of class solidarity.
One of the things too that strikes me about Occupy is it was the 99%. The slogan at that time was the 99%, and there was a real intense feeling that the 1% had tanked the economy in 2008, and the Obama administration had failed to deal with it by 2010, 2011, particularly in the wake of the Republicans, taking back the House, the House and the Senate, I guess, in 2010. And that sort of, I guess, focus on economic inequality, it, at that time, if I remember correctly, had opened the door for Elizabeth Warren. And Sanders was sort of stepping back, waiting for Elizabeth Warren to run by the time we get to 2015. And she didn't. And he stepped into the breach. I mean, they were trying to draft Elizabeth Warren within mm-hmm. at least certain circles. And it was around because she was so closely associated with the banks, you know, or attacking the banks and whatnot. And Bernie stepped into the breach with that I guess, you know, that mantra that that we're living with we're in an oligarchy at this mm-hmm. time. Talk about that as the sort of like, I guess, the sort of real, that seems to be the time where these things coalesce, these different sort of like disparate, I guess, factors.
Sure. I mean, I think that popular anger that was in many ways unleashed by Occupy and then fueled a lot of the Bernie campaign, Bernie 2016, that came from, you know, people seeing conditions of their daily lives really deteriorating. So, you know, millennials are the first generation to be worse off than their parents. People started to see, I did all these things that I was told to do that would give me a good life. I went to college. A lot of people went into major, major debt to get an education, college and grad school, because that's what they were told all their lives was the path to, you know, a better life and to middle class stability. And then people started to see, oh, wait, that's not happening. I can't afford a house. I can't afford to have children. I can't afford a family. You know, there are all these things that their parents had and that a lot of people took for granted that they would also have if they sort of, you know, what is it? I think Obama used to say, worked hard and played by the rules. A lot of Democratic politicians say that. And there were a lot of people who felt like, well, I did that. I've been working hard and playing by the rules and I still don't have anything. And so I think that's really where that came from, was that connection between what people were experiencing in their everyday lives and what was going on more broadly and what the forces were that were keeping them in that position, you know?
Yeah, I should also note, like, that was a big thing that Bill Clinton, who kept saying too, back in the early 90s, was, you know, work hard, play by the rules. Obama had was repeating that, maybe pivoting off a little bit in a more progressive way, but was fundamentally pivoting off the same sort of like premise that our meritocracy is broken, as opposed to the so-called meritocracy that we have is sort of like leading to the same outcomes over and over again, maybe by design, I guess.
Right.
Talk about and I know that you started this book off by, or I should say the reporting that went into this book by focusing on AOC. Talk about how you started there and then ended up branching out and why.
Sure. I mean, when I was originally talking about writing the book, the first vision was something very specific to AOC. It was like a, not exactly a biography, but the AOC generation, that kind of thing. There were a few reasons I shifted away from that. One is that there were maybe 5 books coming out that had exactly the same, you know, focus and title, around AOC and specifically her as a personality. What I wanted to do with my book really was focus on people who are on the ground. So some of the bigger names are obviously in the book, AOC, Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, all of those people are there. But it was important to me to kind of broaden the picture and get away from, you know, frankly, people who a lot has already been written about. I wanted to talk more about the on the ground organizers in different states and places who were inspired by these people. I think AOC was a starting point because it felt like such a natural way to pinpoint this big shift. She's somebody, and she said it herself throughout her campaign, she's somebody who never was supposed to win, right? That's her most famous campaign ad. I'm not the kind of girl who was ever going to be in Congress. And it was really shocking and amazing and frankly thrilling for a lot of people to see her do that, to see her take on an entrenched incumbent with the full support of the Democratic Party. And she toppled him. And that was the first time she ever ran for office. I think it's pretty hard not to be inspired by that on some level, unless you, you know, unless you do not share her politics at all. But she's a pretty remarkable figure. And I had interviewed her twice for The Nation. So that's where I started the book.
And you say, you know, the focus of your book, you wanted to focus more on people on the ground and like the left, from, I guess, the ground up. What were some of the disconnects that you might have observed between, say, politicians like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and maybe what their focus was, from a rhetorical perspective, versus what some organizers were focused on?
So I think, I mean, the best example of that probably was Jonathan Smucker, who's been doing a lot of organizing in Lancaster County in Pennsylvania, which is where he's from. And he is somebody who taught me a lot about organizing in that context, where it's not, I think that people who are doing this work, particularly in certain communities that are more conservative, it's very disconnected from the Twitter discourse, right? They're not out there chanting slogans. They're not saying things like defund the police. In many ways, they're shying away from labeling themselves as socialists, even when they are socialists, right? So virtually everybody I talked to for the book actually is a socialist or had said at some point to me, I am a socialist, but I don't necessarily lead with that in my organizing. And that includes even some socialists in New York City who were trying to organize in communities like the Bronx and certain parts of Brooklyn, where they just felt like the word was not serving them and was not something that they could really meaningfully connect to the policies that they were promoting. So I think that, you know, that's one thing that really gets lost in the reporting on our politics right now, is that so much of it is just about things that happen on Twitter. And people are not really paying as much attention to what's happening in different communities on the ground. I'm from Buffalo, New York. I end the book talking about India Walton, who actually won the Democratic primary for mayor in 2021, which was a truly stunning moment to me as somebody who, you know, was born and raised in Buffalo, which is a very different environment than New York City, much more conservative. And then she was crushed by the Democratic establishment in the general election because they colluded with Republicans to, you know, to prevent her from winning. But that's something that only happened because people were doing work on the ground. That's not something that happened because everybody who votes in Buffalo is on Twitter and got really into AOC or something like that. It was like, you know, very much had to do with investment. Working Families Party invested in talking to people in communities in Buffalo that had been completely overlooked for years.
I want to ask you like what constitutes the broad left, but I want to just stop for a moment too on that, what you found with the organizers finding that the word socialist wasn't working for them, and that it was not like the idea, because Bernie Sanders started off his campaign in 2020 differently than he did in 2016. I mean, obviously he was, I think, more prepared to win in some ways, at least I think from his perspective in 2020 than he was in 2016 in terms of what his agenda was for running. But he started off his campaign by trying to explain or, you know, present the idea of democratic socialism and socialism to some extent in his, like, almost his opening speech of his campaign, maybe the second one. That dynamic where the socialists that you spoke to felt like it wasn't necessary to sell socialism as an ideology, but rather as a set of issues or, you know, specific to the place and the time. Talk about that a little bit more. I'm curious about that dynamic.
Sure. I mean, I think that there's two things I would say about that. One is that sometimes there's a difference between making a sort of tactical or strategic choice in a particular race to not sort of front and center socialism as such, or to avoid the word or something like that. To me, that doesn't mean that you're less committed to the ideology. For some people, they're not at all committed to the ideology and they don't care about the word and they don't feel, you know, Jessica Cisneros, who ran in South Texas, she's a Justice Democrat backed candidate. And I was talking to someone about her campaign and he said she really didn't want to use that word because she's not a socialist. It doesn't mean anything to her. She didn't think it would mean anything to most people in her community. In New York City, I think the issue was more around people have certain associations with the word, and that people were DSA candidates in New York City were sort of trying to do two things at once. They were trying to win particular races in particular communities and also make a connection for people between socialism as an ideology and a practice, frankly, more than an identity, and the issues and the improvements in quality of life that it could yield. And I think that goes back to, you know, a much earlier era in our country in the 10s, 20s, and 30s, when there were socialists in office all over the country, and the phrase sewer socialism sort of came out of that. And that's the idea that you can connect municipal services and improvements in quality of life in a city to socialism, right? To public ownership of public goods and getting people, making that link in people's minds between what does it mean when I say I'm a socialist and what can that do for you? What can that do for us? So, you know, people approach it really differently and it depends on the individual and the particular election. But I think people were doing that in different ways in different parts of the country.
So what does constitute, as you write about the new left, like what does, what is the left part of that new left? Like what constitutes that the left?
The way that I use it in my book, and I think there's a paragraph where I just sort of tried to make it very explicit, but is just, what I mean by that is people who are to the left of the Democratic Party and support policies that are not part of the official platform of the Democratic Party. So Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, immigrants' rights, abortion rights, but abortion rights in a sort of framework that is distinct from the way the Democratic Party supports abortion rights, which is mostly to say the word abortion or say reproductive freedom and then not really protected in any meaningful way. I mean, we lost Roe. So clearly they failed to protect it. I think that, you know, it's not what everybody left. And I think one thing I also talk about in the book is that the left is a kind of an amorphous broad term that means different things to different people. I was sort of amused when I've been talking about this book and going around the country, how many people think that I mean just Democrats, that I mean actually Democratic voters or members of the Democratic Party, and that is the left. And that's sort of part of the problem and part of what I'm trying to get at in the book, that in fact there's a movement that's pretty separate and distinct from that.
Go ahead.
Well, how does it manifest its distinction? I mean, within our politics, how is that distinction manifested? I mean, yes, the Democratic Party failed to codify Roe v. Wade. I suspect that was a function of like overconfidence that it would not be overturned and a sense of like, why step into a political fight that is ultimately going to be, you know, for an insurance policy. I mean, now we know why you do that. And they did that with, they're in the process of doing that with marriage equality and, the right to marry within races because, you know, well, who knows with the Supreme Court, but how does that left distinct from the Democratic Party, work and maybe, you know, manifest itself and how much of that is, it just a function of, well, from your perspective, how does it manifest itself?
I think it's, it means, again, I mean, it really does just mean different things to different people. And I think that it's not as if you can't be part of the left if you vote Democratic. I talked to many, many people who still vote for Democrats, but they're very critical of the party as an institution. I think that, you know, part of the issue is that progressive, the word progressive has become really a kind of mushy umbrella term, and that's on purpose in a lot of ways, because people who are not really part of the left want to position themselves. You know, Andrew Cuomo used to describe himself many, many times, described himself in public as a true progressive or a real progressive or the actual champion of progressive politics. And so
he also, to be fair, he also described himself, I think, as a Muslim woman, as a gay man.
Right.
Think, I mean, he had a long list of things that he would describe himself as. It was,
that's very true.
And never as a criminal, which was odd. Hmm. But be that as it may, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He certainly never described himself as a socialist. That's one right. distinction he didn't make. And there's a difference. There's a difference within the left, right, between people who will say I'm a progressive Democrat and people who are comfortable saying I'm a democratic socialist. So there are different parts of the left. I just really mean it to be anyone who, again, is to the left of the official sort of mainstream Democratic Party and its positions, policy positions.
How much of, like, where does the perspective on electoralism fit in that, right? I mean, because, like, AOC is, I mean, she's a Democratic congressperson,
right?
You know, and I think her positions are to the left of where the center of the Democratic Party is, but in terms of, like, manifesting, you know, the way that she operates, where does she fall in that category of the left? Does participation in electoralism, or at least, you know, I mean, in a fairly concerted way, right? I mean, she runs for office. She's encouraging people to vote and be involved in that system. I think she also encourages things like mutual aid and organizing in a way that we haven't seen from Democratic politicians, like you say, in generations. But I'm just curious where that line comes down. Some people draw it pretty definitively. And we also have to say, I guess, like, as like an asterisk, is we're talking about American politics. And right. Our left is not – our left is generally not as left as, you know, European left or Latin American left. Or that's African right. left, for that matter.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I consider AOC part of the left. You could certainly find people who would disagree with me on that and say that she, her willingness to toe the line in certain ways, her votes on certain bills, her relationship with Nancy Pelosi, makes her not part of the left. I try not to get involved in sort of policing those boundaries. I think it's more about what you do than what you say you are, right? So if you are fighting on the same side as me on X, Y, or Z policy issue, and it seems that you're doing work that is actually advancing the cause of justice in this area or that area, then I consider you a comrade. Not everybody would make that same... Not everybody agrees with that. And I don't think, you know, but it's sort of like, it's like being a feminist or being a socialist. Those are both terms that mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And I'm not somebody who would ever say, well, I'm kicking you out of the feminist tent or what. I don't have that authority. And to me, I subscribe to the bell hooks view of feminism, which is that it's a practice. It's a thing anybody can do and opt into. It's the struggle against sexist oppression. That's an action. It's not a static identity. And I would say that is also true about the left. In terms of electoralism, I mean, that's a debate that's live even within a smaller subset of the left, even within socialist organizations. There's a lot of controversy around, how useful is it to participate in electoral politics? When does it become counterproductive? Is it a dead end? And all of those conversations. And those are ongoing, and they have been for years.
How integral has the labor movement been to the construction of the left over the past, you know, the 5 years or so since it's kind of, there's been some new life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the resurgence of organized labor is one of the most exciting developments that is sort of an outgrowth of, and also a kind of running along the same track as this rise of the new left. There's a whole chapter in my book about organized labor. It's, you know, it's something that is really unfolding before our eyes. I don't know that we really know exactly where it's going. I was at an event the other night where Chris Smalls was talking. He's the Amazon labor union organizer. And he was saying, look, we did this thing in a warehouse that mainstream unions in this country had not really had written off as a site for organizing. Right. And he was like, but young people together figured out a way to do it. And that's a very exciting thing. And I think it's a real shot in the arm for organized labor. There's still a lot of tensions within that, right? I think there are plenty of people who are already leaders, labor leaders, who are skeptical of a lot of these new organizers and the new energy coming into the movement. I think it's really great for everybody and would be great if they could, you know, find a way to move forward together and that we would all be a lot more powerful together. But I understand some of those tensions. I think people who've been around for a long time and doing union work for a long time, you know, they some of them cannot handle sort of upstarts coming in. And it's similar in some ways to the dynamic in the Democratic Party, right? That some people are embracing AOC and this wave of youthful progressive energy, and some people are not.
Right. I mean, and some are openly hostile. I mean, both right. in the context of the union dynamic and within the Democratic Party.
Right.
How much of how important it is it for folks of the left to delineate only? And I know that you don't think it's a helpful thing to do. But how important is it to delineate in the context of being able to say we are entering into a coalition with the Democrats, the unions, whatever it is, to achieve X, Y, and Z? I mean, because – I mean, I think we're seeing that in the context of – we see it in the House. Like, I mean, you know, we can track sort of like the squad and – mm-hmm. There are compromises that they're making that are ostensibly, you know, to build legislative coalitions, I guess, that will hopefully pay off in the future. Like, how much of that, where is the left in that sort of like, you know, who are we going to build a coalition with? And how limited will that be, and to what ends?
I think the best example of that in recent memory is 2020 and the way that people really came together to get Trump out, right? Because there are different – the Democratic Party, you know, I said in the book that some people were actively – a small sort of subset of people were actively excited about Joe Biden and electing Joe Biden. I don't think that was a very broad group. I think most people who came together to defeat Trump just wanted to defeat Trump, just wanted to get him out of the White House. And that was the sort of necessary condition. Any leftist organizer would tell you, we've got to get rid of that guy first before we can really get anything else done. And we saw groups like Pennsylvania Stands Up in Pennsylvania, and they organized. They had a very interesting model of doing this where they sent people door to door. And I think it really made a tremendous difference there. And I think they really helped Biden win in Pennsylvania. And they said to people, we want you to vote for Biden for this reason and that reason. We don't think he's very good. We think we deserve more and better. But it's very important in this election that you vote for Joe Biden. I think you can have this kind of dual track approach on a lot of these issues. And particularly when we're locked into a duopoly, which we are for now, right? I think that to me, I don't see any signs that we're going to have a viable third party anytime soon in American politics. these are the conditions we're fighting in. This is the terrain we're fighting on. And there's a way to do it where we can be honest with people about what we believe, where we're coming from, and what we think, the vision of the world that we think we could have, while at the same time saying, as an intermediary step, we're joining with this or that group or with the Democratic Party and trying to get, you know, this particular thing done or this particular person elected. And I, that's the way you do it, I think.
You write specifically about Pennsylvania in the book, and you know, you're talking about that dynamic. And I can't remember the last time we've had two Democratic senators from Pennsylvania. It's been, I think, a long while. And what does Pennsylvania show in terms of, and we should say, you wrote this, you were doing the reporting on this over a year ago in Pennsylvania, when, you know, the idea that John Fetterman could be the senator there was, you know, I don't think it was an obvious something that would happen. What does Pennsylvania show you about, or us, I guess, about where the left is going in this country?
I think, you know, Fetterman was a really great and exciting example of somebody who talked about economic issues, who talked about everyday sort of economic concerns shared by a lot of people in this country, and did it effectively. And he ran against somebody also who was just sort of comically out of touch and ridiculous. And one thing we saw from the midterms is this, you know, and this was not just in Pennsylvania, but nationally, a rejection of the Republican candidates as the real extremists, right? I mean, you hear over and over again that the Democrats are going to be punished because they've gone too far left, and people don't like defund the police, or they don't like abortion on demand, or all of these things that the party is not actually supporting, which is sort of a separate point. But they've, you know, successfully in some ways tarred the Democrats as supporters of these things. And what we actually saw is that, in fact, voters don't like people like Blake Masters, who's like a totally creepy fascist gun nut in Arizona. You know, nobody likes that. They don't like what the GOP is selling. And I think that was the, to me, the biggest message and the most interesting outcome of the midterms. You know, they ran, is that the people the GOP ran were singularly unappealing, not just as in their policy positions, but also kind of personally bad candidates. And John Fetterman is the opposite of that. He's a good candidate. He's a personally appealing person, yeah, a guy who attracted people's attention in a good way. And he won on talking about, you know, issues that people care about.
The interesting thing about that is that I think, like, you know, makes that dynamic, you know, you compare it to, let's say, Ohio, right? Is that Fetterman made a joke out of Oz, but the narrative that he made a joke out of him was sort of like the opposite side of the coin of what Fetterman delivered or attempted to deliver, which is like, you know, I understand the issues that you have in, you know, your kitchen table issues and what you struggle with on a daily basis. And not coincidentally, he had already defined Oz as someone who was so out of touch, like both in terms of like, he doesn't even live here. And in fact, where he ultimately lives is like, you know, in some other stratosphere of celebrity doctorhood. That both sides of that narrative matched each other in a way that like was extremely helpful. Mm. It seems like that. I don't know what Tim Ryan was doing in Ohio, and Ohio may be just a different instance. But, you know, you could have applied that same sort of dynamic to J.D. Vance with what Tim Ryan seemed to be running on. It didn't quite get there with that. And it really wasn't so much about it was much more grounded. Fetterman seemed to localize that race in a way that is difficult to do in like politics for senators. And I know that's interesting. And so where does the left go next? I mean, like, is it just maintaining some of the same track, or is it like, how does it grow at this point? Because it feels like, you know, the DSA exploded during, you know, in the wake of the Bernie run. But it seems like, you know, when Bernie lost in 2020, there was a lot of fracturing, and some of that was, some of the message was absorbed by Democratic politicians, you know, increasingly, but maybe incrementally more so. But what is happening on the left right now, and where does, you know, where is the path forward?
I mean, these are really good questions, and I'm thinking a lot about them. I think that Sunrise is a good example of an organization that is pretty new still, that had a lot of success and generated a lot of really impressive headlines 2018, 2019. And we don't have a Green New Deal, and that's sort of, I'm not going to say that it's run out of steam. I think they are making measurable progress on that, but there's a they've sort of hit a little bit of a wall. And I know that they're internally as an organization going through a big kind of reckoning now and trying to figure out where do we go forward from here. DSA is in a similar place. And I think that I would say that we've, in some ways, the left is sort of plateauing. I don't think it's losing steam, but I think we're at a point where we're trying to figure out how do we level up and get through to the next, the next big jump. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen with that. I think one thing that gives me a lot of hope about it is that the reason we have this prominent left now in a way that we certainly didn't when I was coming of age in the 90s, is that people have gotten more serious about being strategic and thinking about how power works, right? So I was a big Nader person in college. I loved Ralph Nader, really admired him. I got involved with the campaign. He got less than 3% of the vote nationwide, right? That was not a success. That campaign was not in any way a success. The Green Party was not particularly a success. And what we're doing now is seeing, you know, in 2020, Bernie Sanders became the only person in American history to get the person who called himself a socialist who got the closest ever to the American presidency, right? And that was pretty remarkable for anyone who's been alive for, you know, longer than 30 years. And that was a big moment. And that didn't happen by accident. That didn't happen overnight. That happened because of years of groundwork and trying to figure out how you can, you know, break through against all odds and against institutions that are all sort of aligned against you. So that's where we are now. But the good news is that people are thinking about it in a much more serious way than I think that they were even 10 or 20 years ago.
One final question, because it just came up on my IM, and it's a good point. For the lack of a better term, resistance libs, right? Mm-hmm. This sort of phenomenon that we've had now two midterms since Donald Trump was elected in 2016, where Democrats have outperformed themselves historically and outperformed as a measure against what parties out of in power generally do during midterms. And largely, although, you know, I wouldn't say totally, because we've had like an increased youth vote, and I suspect that is, you know, more of, I don't know if it's more of a function of like organizations like the DSA or just sort of the idea that people have moved to the left, but a big part of it is, you know, so-called resistant libs, you know, particularly women, broadly speaking, who have come out, both black and white, for that matter, suburban to some extent as well, have come out in exercise of negative partisanship. Like, you know, how much of like awareness is there and acceptance of that, and it so that can either be utilized in some fashion or reckoned with or a coalition built with? I mean, where does that fit in?
I mean, that is the main challenge facing the left, I think, is to say, there was this huge group of people, you know, across the country who, for all kinds of reasons, hated Donald Trump, didn't want him in office anymore. That kind of, you know, negative partisanship and that kind of just sort of rejection of this one guy, that's going to go in different ways. For some people, that was ideologically rooted. For some people, it really wasn't, right? Some people, it was just, ew, I don't like him. He's awful. I want him out. Now, some of those people are going to be radicalized. Some of them have been radicalized, actually, as part of the process of engaging. And I talked to some of those people who were like, essentially they were just sort of standard Democrats. And they slowly over the years were like, why are things worse and worse? Why are we going backwards on issues I care about, like abortion rights? What is the party doing or not doing that they could be doing better? And that's sort of the indivisible thesis, right? That's a big group, a mass constituency, and those people do have some kind of class consciousness. They're not socialists for the most part, but they have some critique of the party and critique of our politics that is broader than Trump is bad. That's just not going to be true for everybody. There's going to be plenty of people who wanted Trump out so that we could, quote unquote, go back to normal, who wanted to go back to brunch, who just want things to be kind of, you know, nice and familiar again and less openly upsetting, right? Less of this sort of very, very open racism of Donald Trump and sexism. And some of those people are going to just sort of drift back to the center. I think that's fine. I think the challenge is how many of those people can we get engage in a serious critique and help them see themselves as part of something broader and more sustainable than just sort of rooting out this one person. And that's happening. I mean, that's happening all over the country.
Raina Lipsitz, author of The Rise of the New Left, How Young Radicals Are Shaping the Future of American Politics. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to your book in the podcast and YouTube description. Again, much appreciated.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will read your IMs. We will talk about a number of other things and play some clips, all those things. And I think we'll probably take your phone calls as well. Just one IM, because I've gotten a lot of this on the Twitter and to the extent that it still exists. And here I've seen Scombread. I've seen conflicting reports on student loan forgiveness. Was hoping you guys would give an update and also predictions on how you think it'll play out. Now the midterms are over. I hope they don't just close the book and crap on millions of us. Left is best. The Biden administration has filed a petition with the Supreme Court to address the two court rulings, I think, that have inhibited the continuation of that program. We obviously will follow that. But on Wednesday, we'll have Astrid Taylor on, who has been championing student loan debt for years, and she will give us an update. I mean, there is a plan B that seems to be floating around there, which is to shift the authority under which the Biden administration relieved the loans. We will talk to her about the potential for that efficacy, for that to work. But, you know, even if you think that the chances of it making a difference with this Supreme Court, with this court, the federal courts that we have now are slim, you got to do it, it seems to me. But we'll talk to the expert on Wednesday, which will be the day before Thanksgiving.
Mm.
Not by any decision that we've made here, I should say.
No.
That's just the way the calendar worked out. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Not only do you help this show survive and thrive, and also for us to bring you things like Thanksgiving. You'll get the free show free of commercials and also the fun half. So become a member today.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the idea.
That's the gist.
Yep. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Emma, what's happening on ESPN on the day after my Patriots beat Bradley's Jets in the almost the most brutal and heartbreaking way possible?
Yeah.
14 in a row, guys.
So that's the
last seconds.
So that means that's literally 7 years of games against the Patriots in the division.
Since 2015.
That's unbelievable. And even when the Patriots haven't been that good. But anyway, so on ESPN, we'll be talking about some of the World Cup controversy, as well as is Zach Wilson an immature idiot? Gabriel, our regular caller, kind of tipped us off to this, so we'll have to explore that a little bit. As well as the updates to the Kyrie Irving saga and just like general recaps for the NFL week. So youtube.com/ESVN show for that.
I saw a bunch of those guys, Black Hebrew Israelites, that came in front of Barclays Center. They were all at the McDonald's I went to in downtown Brooklyn.
Oh, no way. Yeah. Strike up a conversation.
I didn't realize they were in the area for the Kyrie game.
Oh, yeah. There were many. So we'll be playing some of that footage as well.
See Jaylen Brown? No, we don't need to get into that.
Okay, yeah.
Left Reckoning, we did a show for folks on Sunday, and this I think Friday, maybe we'll release it maybe Sunday, but Brandon Sutton, David Griscom, and I talked about the Tucker Carlson original Blake Masters documentary, which includes footage of Blake Masters crying. So
I saw you tweeted that. So that's was it a full 2-hour documentary?
No, like it was just a half
length?
Hour.
Oh, thank
yeah, God. Unless there's 90 minutes that I missed, in which case I'll have something to do tonight.
What do they do with that all that extra footage now?
I don't know, but there's a lot of cuts in it, especially when he's talking to Trump on the phone. When he's like, "Yeah, you know, I thought we put him on the ropes," and Trump's like, "You know, when Carrie Lake is asked how her family is, she says the election was stolen from Trump." That's what we need you to be like.
Well, you need to pick it up a little bit. Hey, folks, I just want to make this clear. If you are someone who was in any way involved in that production and have access to that footage,
the B-roll,
want to make it absolutely clear that if you were to send us an email and, you know, on like some type of burner account.
We'll archive it for
you. And we needed to pick up the footage like in a brown bag underneath like a bench in like Bryant Park or something like that. We could do the whole chalk thing where you put the drop and we'll do it. We will take that footage. And, you know, this periodically I make this reminder. If you have anything, you work for any of these people and you want to leak any of it. And of course, I also give permission in this office for anybody here. Do you want to leak, stuff to Tucker Carlson? Feel free. I mean, that's.
Will do.
Well, that's what's good for the goose is good for the
I got to do it
other,
for free.
The other goose, I guess.
Taking payment.
Yeah. So feel free. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your phone calls and see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Oh. Snuff.
Netflix has what? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.